From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for Terry Gross while she's on vacation. And on today's show, I speak with attorney Martin Garbus. He's considered an expert on First Amendment issues in this country and has also had a firsthand look at systems of justice in other countries, notably the Soviet Union and South Africa. Also today, a conversation with artist Jenny Holzer. Her medium is The Message, printed on posters and electronic billboards. The upcoming 10th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death has prompted rock historian Ed Ward to recall Elvis's first recording session. And book critic John Leonard reviews The World as I Found It, Bruce Duffy's novel of philosophy and philosophers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is attorney Martin Garbus. In the 28 years he's practiced law, Garbus has defended the rights of free speech in some of the country's most controversial and celebrated cases. His clients have included comedian Lenny Bruce, labor organizer Cesar Chavez, and anti-war activist Daniel Ellsberg. Later, Mr. Garbus served as the associate director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Martin Garbus has also actively monitored the legal systems in other countries, the Soviet Union, South Africa, Chile. He has just written a book on the inconsistencies of law internationally and how laws are used for political repression. The book is titled Traitors and Heroes and is published by Athenaeum. Welcome to Fresh Air, Mr. Garbus.
Nice to meet you.
Your first book was written in 1971. It was entitled Ready for the Defense, and it was several stories of several individual clients that you had defended, and one of them was Lenny Bruce in his New York obscenity case in 1964. Why did you take that case?
Well, at that time, Bruce was saying things that ought to be heard at that time. He was talking about the conduct of Lyndon Johnson with respect to Vietnam and the beginning of the Vietnam War. And he was also being prosecuted wrongfully for what was then called obscenity. The remarkable thing is, as you look back now, the kinds of things that he was prosecuted for, the kind of language that he was prosecuted for, you can now see that kind of stuff or hear that kind of language on sitcom, on TV. So that Bruce at that time was an important figure who was making pungent and critical comments about the American political establishment and America's sexual and social mores.
I was wondering if you could draw any comparisons between what happened then, particularly more along the obscenity line, and what's going on now with people say in the moral majority groups that are putting stickers on albums and saying and actually censoring some of the things that we hear.
Well, I think it's the same kind of thing. I recently debated John Sears, who had written the obscenity report for Ed Meese and Ronald Reagan. You may remember about a year ago they came out with a report which allegedly confirmed that if you read things like Lady Chatterley's Lover or other kinds of books that they find objectionable, that you're out, that people are about to go out and commit rape or something like that. So that the kinds of stuff that Meese, Reagan, and John Sears were saying is very evocative. You're quite correct, very evocative of what we lived through in the mid-60s when you had the censorship statutes. People forget that in Philadelphia, New York, and Los Angeles, in the late 50s, you still had statutes under which you could stop films from being shown. You had entire systems of censorship and regulation. It seems like 100 years ago today, but that did exist. I tried cases in the late 50s, early 60s, where you were striking down statutes. One of the cases that I had been involved with, something called The Lovers, a Jean Moreau film, and we took that case out of Ohio up to the United States Supreme Court. If you were to look at that case, that film today, you'd be amazed at how innocuous it is.
I just want to ask you one personal question about this particular case, about the Lenny Bruce case. Was he a very difficult client to defend?
Oh, Bruce was difficult. By the time I met him and in the years that I represented him, he was on a downswing. At that point, he was involved with drugs. I had represented him, let's say, I think it was his third case. He was really getting battered. He could no longer go out and perform. He was afraid of getting arrested every time. He had, in the early 60s, been making a good deal of money. He was able to fill the large halls, I think even very large halls. By the time I met him, he could barely play in small nightclubs that seated 200 people for several reasons. One, he was starting to get incoherent because of the drugs, because of the pressure, psychological and legal. So he was very difficult, and the longer I was with him, the more difficult he became.
Did you know that he would be convicted before you even went to trial?
Well, in our case, he was convicted, but it was ultimately reversed, so that I knew that there was a high chance of him being convicted, but I also knew there was a high chance of it being reversed. He didn't have that confidence. His belief was that he was going to get skewered throughout the legal system. He had no faith at this point any longer in the legal system. All he had seen was that the arrests made of him in Los Angeles and Chicago and other places, he would win some, lose some, but they would never go away. So he was a perfect example of somebody who was winning cases and was just being battered by the system.
It's a tragic story. He actually died in 1966 during the appeal.
Yes, he did.
So he never really got to see any of the outcome, never even had a chance to renew his faith in the legal system.
No, and I think that probably by the time he died, it was too late. There was no way. I think it was his feeling. Even had we won in New York, he knew that if he went out and played in Los Angeles or some other place, he'd only be arrested again. He had a lot of very scathing criticism of the legal system and of police. And, of course, it were those people that were arresting him and trying him. So when you went into a courtroom and you listened to Lenny's remarks about judges and the police, you could just see the judges blanch. I also saw the trial in Chicago before I represented him in New York. And it was like, you know, hitting the people who were then going to try and judge you. Lenny could have been provident, could have stepped back, could have stopped doing that. The more they arrested him, the more he did it, the angrier he became. So he was kind of in a circle where he just couldn't pull out of it.
My guest is attorney Martin Garbus. You have been written about, and you are considered to be, one of the experts on First Amendment issues in this country. What do you think? What rights do you think under the First Amendment are now being threatened today, 1987?
Well, I think that Irangate, for example, I think in a way relates to the First Amendment. We are told by Reagan and the people who run the government that there are certain things that we cannot know, we the people and we Congress cannot know, because it somehow threatens national security. National security always impacts on the First Amendment. That's one of the areas in which the government is supposedly allowed to withhold information from us on the grounds that even though it would be helpful to have the people know about it, there is some threat to the public whole if that information came out. The justification for covert wars, again, is this is the kind of information, the extent of the war, who we're doing it against, should be withheld from us. It's an alleged exception to the First Amendment. What's happened in all of these areas is that the Reagan administration has overstated the national security interests. Every time they go into court to protect their covert operations, what they do is they claim that the First Amendment can be hampered, that there should be confidential information given to the CIA and other agencies that we should not know about it. So that's one very large area, and most people don't appreciate, I don't think, Irangate as being in many ways a First Amendment area. One of the interesting things also is Congress now in Irangate is complaining. They're saying, we didn't know this and we didn't know this. And to some extent, Congress has set up an opposition to the Reagan administration. But the reality is that the Congress for the last 10 years has permitted it. And but for this, the wrongdoings of the Olivers and the Poindexters, the size of the wrongdoings, the horrendous nature of the wrongdoings, Congress probably wouldn't have objected. They've permitted Casey to run around as he did for many, many years. So I'm not terribly sympathetic to Congress when they claim we didn't know.
But on the other hand, we do have a freedom of the press. Once the press got a hold of that information, we were allowed to print it. So all this information could come out.
Well, yes, but there have been attempts, and I'm sure you're aware of it, of the Reagan administration to interfere with the press. For example, when the story started to break, one of the things that Oliver North said of the press, and he was saying it and he was articulating a view that I feel was held by the Reagan administration, that what the press was doing, namely divulging all the secret information about Irangate and Contragate, would at another time, he said, be considered treason. And what he was talking about was evocative of the McCarthy period. There have been other instances. For example, there was a book that came out, both from Viking Press and Random House, talking about the shoot-down of the KL-007. And in both those cases, with respect to both those books, both the CIA, then Casey, and the Attorney General tried to interfere with those books because those books claimed that America was not without fault with respect to that. And there have been other instances where the Reagan administration has tried to interfere with some of the information that has been disseminated concerning Libya, the right to bomb Libya, the extent to which Libya is allegedly involved in terrorism, and information that the Washington Post had, which showed that a lot of that evidence about Libya's involvement in terrorism was created by the administration to justify the bombings.
But on the other hand, it's unlike, say, that case in England where the BBC was going to do a documentary and they were threatened under the State Secrets Act, and the government actually went into the newsroom and took everything out. They were not allowed to even say it.
I think you've made a good point. Britain has the Official Secrets Act. We don't. The question is whether the Reagan administration is trying to push the legislation that they have and is trying to interpret the Constitution so that, in effect, there is an Official Secrets Act.
And now there's going to be a presidential election coming up. Will that stop that?
Well, you mean the Reagan election?
Yes.
Well, I don't know that it'll stop it, depending on who gets in. I think what's going on right now, for example, in the Persian Gulf, when the press is being kept out of the Persian Gulf, allegedly the press is being kept out of the Persian Gulf because it would jeopardize American interests. Because if you showed where the Kuwaiti ships were sailing, that somehow this would jeopardize American interests. The Iranians know exactly where those ships are sailing. Anybody who's there knows exactly where those ships are sailing. The reason the press is kept out is because the Reagan administration wants to keep certain information away from the American people. As, for example, this recent story about us firing at some Iranian aircraft, or stories which would show that the government has been remarkably lax in the whole question of mines and minesweepers. So I think you're seeing right now, in Grenada did the same thing. They kept the press out for a period of time. So I think the Official Secrets Act is horrible. The question is, and I'm afraid of the answer, the question is, would the Reagan administration prefer an Official Secrets Act, and are they trying to make an Official Secrets Act of the present legislation?
Could they get away with that, though? I mean, given
the
nature of Congress?
They got away with shutting down information on Grenada. They are getting away now with shutting down information on the Persian Gulf. They got away with trying to interfere with the KL-007. They got away with disseminating information. I mean, the Reagan administration is an extraordinarily lawless administration, whether it be Meese or Bork or William Bradford Reynolds, but it's an administration that is focused on ignoring the law.
And so it seems that you are obviously opposed to the nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court.
I think the nomination of Bork would be a tragedy. I think that putting aside the question, it seems to me that the Congress and the people can reject Supreme Court nominations on grounds other than if they're just crooks or fools. In other words, if the Reagan administration is trying to say that the Congress or the people have a limited ground for object, that if it's like Haynesworth or Carswell, the people rejected under Nixon because they were inept, or if somebody is dishonest, the Reagan administration is saying those are the only two grounds. But Bork is something else. Bork typifies what the administration feels, namely that you can now rewrite the Constitution. He believes, unlike most lawyers in this country, that there is no value to precedent. He believes that you can look at a case anew and come to a totally different decision. Now, you have a court that, with Powell gone and Bork, with Bork coming on, will be so skewed to the right that I think that you will have a rewriting of an enormous amount of legal decisions. And this affects women, it affects black, it affects minorities, it affects consumer groups. I think that Bork's view is a radical view. There is no other judge that I know who has it, and I think it is perfectly appropriate to disapprove of a man who is so out of line with traditional legal thinking.
Well, then who else should be nominated in his place? Who else is available?
Well, I think ultimately what I think the fundamental issue is is can you, when you look at a nominee, look at his political thought and some of his writing? The Reagan position is that if a man is competent, and they claim that Bork is, then neither the Congress nor the people have the right to ask him about his political views. Now, I disagree with that. I don't see why, since he ultimately is appointed to a position which is in many ways political, why you cannot deal with the fact that someone like Bork will totally rewrite the Constitution in a radical way that is out of harmony with the thinking of most lawyers. And citizens. I don't mean to narrow it just to lawyers. But I think that his views, if they were fully known, would be found to be offensive. And what you have now is this Reagan public relations campaign, which is trying to portray him as a centrist.
My guest is attorney Martin Garbus. His new book is entitled Traitors and Heroes. We'll be back after a few seconds to talk about some of his international experiences. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Martin Garbus, one of the country's leading authorities on the First Amendment. His new book, Traitors and Heroes, is a memoir of his experiences in the Soviet Union, Chile, and South Africa, as well as a look at our own judicial system. Let's get off our shores just a little bit. We've spent a lot of time there. You were invited to go to South Africa to observe trials, notably that of the Africana poet Brighton Breitenbach, as well as trials of 11 African National Congress leaders. Were you invited because of your own extensive experience dealing with civil rights in this country?
Yes. Yes, I was asked to go because it was thought that I would have some understanding of the political situation of South Africa and the political situation of the defendants in the dock, and that I might in some way be able to help them by presenting the view of the groups that asked me to go. I was then asked to go by the International League of Justice, the International League for Human Rights, and PEN, which is a writers group. When I went there, I met with the defendants, I met with the judges, I met with the lawyers. And as the book indicates, one of the things that ultimately happened was I came back, wrote a series of articles for several papers, the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, the Los Angeles Times. And as a result of it, I found myself the subject of a disbarment proceeding.
Why should that happen? Why should what you say in South Africa have any effect on what you're doing in this country?
It shouldn't. I mean, the tone of your voice is that it's incredulous that something like that could have an effect. The Bar Association took the position that if a lawyer comments about judges in South Africa, and if he criticizes them in South Africa, and if there's anything in any information that he states inaccurately, then he is subject to the supervision of the Bar Association. Now, of course, the interesting thing is the Bar Association never went after lawyers who wrote critically of the Soviet Union. They never went after lawyers who wrote critically of other governments. It seems to me that the reason that the Bar Association ultimately went after me is because the South African government had its friends in high places, and they were able to file a petition against me, and that petition was entertained for far too long.
They went after you, but they didn't get you.
They went after me, but they didn't get me.
This isn't the first time you've been threatened in your
career. No. When I was in the army, as the book indicates, I was the subject of treason charges. There was a military proceeding brought against me, and ultimately there also the court martial proceedings were ultimately dropped.
And in Chile, you were threatened with death.
In Chile, whenever you go around to these countries, you are seen as an enemy. The understanding in some of those countries is that the stuff that you're going to write is not going to be favorable to the administration. In many ways, lawyers like myself after the press is kicked out, as they've been kicked out in South Africa, as they were kicked out in Chile and severely circumscribed in Chile, lawyers like myself who can go down and look at political trials and then report back, hold a press conference in the United States, write articles, are the only source of information that the American public has about those kinds of proceedings. And I, colleagues of mine who have done this, and they've done it in El Salvador and other countries as well, do so often at great risk to themselves. And the number of Americans now who have been killed or harmed in faraway places doing this kind of stuff multiplies. If they can kill nuns in El Salvador, they can certainly kill lawyers.
Granted, you were frightened. Granted, you were very scared. But I wonder, did these threats ever galvanize you in some way, convince you that your position was correct?
Well, I think that the question of fear when you're doing these things, I don't know that the fears ever made me think that my position was correct. Frequently, the problem is sometimes your fears lock you into positions that may not be helpful. For example, if you're going down there, you're allegedly trying to be you're trying to be objective. If in South Africa, where you had a different situation, one wanted to be credible and one wanted to come back and write somewhat or speak somewhat dispassionately. So the danger for someone like me was that the tension and the anxiety might force you into a position where you're becoming too much of an advocate, which might be appropriate in an American courtroom and would be appropriate representing a client, but becomes at some level inappropriate over there.
In 1976, you went to the Soviet Union. You met with Anatoly Sharansky, Andrei Sakharov. In fact, you even smuggled a letter from Andrei Sakharov to President Carter. Here we are 11 years later, and Mr. Sharansky has been allowed to go to Israel. Mr. Sakharov is no longer in exile. There is this, or we're hearing, about this new policy of openness. Do you think it really is a new policy of openness?
Well, I think what's going on in the Soviet Union is remarkable. The question as to what is its lasting effect and what happens if Gorbachev cannot succeed are all very important questions. But when I was in the Soviet Union, I was there about 3 weeks ago, and one evening on TV, there was like a Donahue show trying to get people's impressions about glasnost and perestroika. Perestroika relates to the restructuring of the society. And people would call in, give their opinions, and then what they did is the commentator went and started to interview people on the street in Leningrad. And I went out to the street because it was somewhat near the hotel that I was at, and I watched this. And so far as I could see, people were giving open, honest answers to the questions, what do you feel about this, what do you feel about this? Now, which is not to say that the people felt totally free to be totally critical in the way one could be in this country. For example, some of the people that I met there were publishing a new magazine called Glasnost, and that magazine had information which was very critical of the Soviet Union. It was critical of the Soviet Union's position in Afghanistan. It was critical with respect to the bureaucracy. It called the bureaucracy based on a subsystem of fear, and it also was critical of pure socialism, indicating that the market economy would not work. Now, what happens to that magazine is, I think, an important symbol for glasnost. It's not the final answer, and if something happens to the magazine, it doesn't mean that glasnost will hold, but it's an important issue to look at.
You smuggled an issue of that magazine out of the Soviet Union. How did you do that?
Well, I did it in my inside jacket pocket. My wife, as a matter of fact, got stopped, and she, because the guards thought that she was carrying it, and she was held in a room for about an hour, and everything was held up, and they searched her looking for it, and they went through our luggage meticulously. I think that what has now happened with respect to glasnost is that on August 11th, the Soviet Union for the first time indicated its displeasure with the magazine. When I was there, Gregor Rantz, who was himself a political prisoner who had been jailed for 10 years because of his involvement in an underground magazine, Gregor Rantz had asked the government for permission to publish that magazine. The government never responded. And for about a month, the government has not responded. Gregor Ants asked me to take the magazine out. He asked me to try and get it published in the United States. He asked me to try and get segments of it published. And I have thus far in certain periodicals, and I've spoken to certain publishers about getting the entire magazine published here. What has just happened is that the Soviet Union, through TASS, has come out and indicated that the magazine is, to use their words, quote, immoral and unnecessary, and that there is no need for an unofficial press. Now, the remarkable thing about Glasnost is the first time since the 1920s that you have had an unofficial press, or that you've had a magazine which has been in any way critical of the Soviet Union. Now, the TASS statements don't mean the magazine is closed down. Gregor Ants, as of yesterday, was saying he still hopes that the magazine will be published. I think what's happening with the magazine is important, but it has to be looked at, I think, in the entire context of what's going around there.
And I think in the entire context of political prisoners in general, you are someone who's advocating this international bill of global rights. Briefly, if this could actually be created, how would this possibly be enforced? It reminds me a little bit of UN peacekeeping forces.
Well, I think you're right. I think any time, remember when I was a kid in school and I used to hear about the World Federalists, I thought they were people who were vague, ephemeral, and kind of living with cotton in their heads. And I know also Hannah Arendt, when she wrote years ago about the whole concept of human rights, says it's nonsense, everything is politics ultimately. I think that the human rights movement has come a long way. I think that in the last 30 years, you have seen it become something of significance. It's on the bargaining table at Helsinki. It's in the discussion that ensues now between most countries. Often, it's used for political rhetoric. For example, when Reagan switched his position on the Philippines, he said he did it because of human rights. I don't believe that was the case at all. He did it so that he saw how the fight was going to come out, and he wanted to protect Subic Air Base and American interests there. I think that he uses it solely for political purposes. But I believe that there have been enormous strides made. Things like this don't happen slowly. I think when the World Court, for example, condemned America's position in Nicaragua, it had more force and effect than similar proclamations in the late 40s and early 50s. Did it mean that America stopped the war against Nicaragua? No. Did it mean that America stopped doing illegal actions against Nicaragua? No. But it certainly played a role in establishing America as one of the immoral parties in Nicaragua. So I think it's a concept whose time is coming.
Martin Garvis, thank you very much for being with us today. My guest has been lawyer and activist Martin Garbus. His new book, Traitors and Heroes, is published by Athenaeum. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Bill Raymond of the theater group Mabu Minds, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. from Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, filling in for Terry Gross while she's on vacation. Coming up, artist Jenny Holzer talks about her truisms, a series of sentences which transform literature into visual art. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us how Elvis Presley's very first record changed American music and how that record was made. And book critic John Leonard reviews The World as I Found It, the new novel by Bruce Duffy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday, August 16th, marks the 10th anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, is going to take us back 33 years to a recording session when the King made his very first single.
A lot has been made of the way Elvis Presley took black music and added some country seasoning, turning it into rock and roll. But the people who criticize him for this, usually using the word ripoff, forget that he also took country songs and added some blues seasoning to them, turning them, too, into rock and roll. In fact, his very first record had blues singer Arthur Crudup's That's All Right Mama on one side and Bill Monroe's Blue Moon of Kentucky on the other. Here's the Monroe original. Bluegrass has never been a particularly popular form of country music, but Blue Moon of Kentucky made some waves on country radio in the summer of 1954, at least in Kentucky and Tennessee. That's probably where Elvis heard it, and it's also very likely that he didn't like it much. Bill Monroe can be as arrogant as he is talented, which is why Elvis probably felt it was okay to make fun of him. Another reason is that Elvis was scared. He'd whipped off That's All Right Mama in record time on July 5th, but he and guitarist Scotty Moore and bassist Bill Black had been trying to come up with something for the other side of the record for several days after that, with no luck. Goofing off, they began to mock Bill Monroe, and all of a sudden the song fell into place. Sam Phillips turned on the tape and recorded a slice of history. Listen to what he says when he comes out of the control room at the end of this take.
Blue moon of Kentucky, keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. Blue moon of Kentucky, keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and proved untrue. It was on one moonlight night, the stars were shining bright. Whispered from on high, love. Kentucky, keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue.
Fine, man. Well, that's different. That's a pop song now, little bat.
As he so often was, Sam was right. It was a pop song, and it was something different. Not only that, but Elvis knew he could surpass it. And a few minutes later, he did.
Blue moon. Blue moon, blue moon, keep shining bright. blue moon, keep on shining bright. You're gonna bring me back on my baby tonight. Blue moon, keep shining bright. I say blue moon, I can't forget to keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. I say blue moon, I've given Kentucky to keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. Well, the heat was on one moonlight night, stars shining bright, whisper on high, love, say goodbye. Blue moon, I've given Kentucky to keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue.
The rest is history. The record was out within a week, and it was played on Memphis radio stations first. People called up wanting to know what a white guy was doing singing blues, while others wanted to know what a black guy was doing singing bluegrass. Soon enough, we all got used to the idea. It was just Elvis, doing what he did best.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Do you remember what was on the flip side of Blue Moon of Kentucky? Elvis, singing That's All Right, Mama.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. She done told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you fooling with, she ain't no good to you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is artist Jenny Holzer. When she was in art school, she began collecting diagrams from textbooks and became more interested in the captions than the diagrams. This collection led to the kind of work she's been doing since the late 70s. She writes one-line sayings for electronic signs, either existing electronic billboards or signs that she might create for a specific site. Generally, her art can be seen in public places, flashing above Times Square, in an urban shopping mall. Holzer started creating art for public places through a series of posters she called truisms. She plastered her posters all over Manhattan, and when I spoke with Jenny Holzer, I asked her about them.
It's a series of one-liners on almost any possible topic, written from any point of view. There are far-left ones, there are far-right ones, there are good common-sense ones.
Where did these come from?
From my mind, I would write to various subjects, such as war or death or love or all those classic things. And then I'd try to make them sound as if they were real truisms.
Oh, really? You wrote these?
Yeah.
It's funny because they're alphabetical. They start with A, starting with, a little knowledge can go a long way.
Mm-hmm.
You could have very easily said a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Better to have fresh ones.
We are supposed to then digest these things that you were saying and make them apply to us?
I hope they make the reader go through some kind of process of self-definition that you can go through and pick out the ones that you hate or the ones that you like, and hopefully maybe at the end of it be somewhat more tolerant just because you've had to subject yourself to all of them. And they all seem equally true.
These truisms that were initially put on a poster, did you get that reaction from people?
I would find when I would go back and look at the posters that I'd put in the street that people would check things and say yes afterwards or would cross out things and say no. And then finally, sometimes people would write messages back to me.
When did you decide to then move on to electronic signs?
I think when I became tired of skulking around in the middle of the night, freezing and getting covered in wheat paste, I decided to move on. Also, when I first had access to the board at Spectacolor in Times Square, I thought it was kind of a logical 20th century way to put out my information.
How did that happen?
Another artist, Jane Dixon, organized the project in conjunction with the Public Art Fund, and ever since then, I think then being 1981 or 1982, a different artist has been able to put up material on the sign. And I was one of the first ones who did it.
Is it a very expensive proposition to be working in electronic signs?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes it's absolutely free when I use a sign that's up than an existing sign, and my things are just slotted in with advertising or the regular public service announcements. Then it's cost absolutely nothing at all.
Where else has that happened other than Times Square?
Many places. Just finished a project in San Francisco. We had the scoreboard, or I had the scoreboard at Candlestick Park during a Mets and Giants game. Had the sign on the freeway in San Francisco, and I actually had all the little electronic signs on the Muni on the subway system there.
What did they say? What did these signs say?
On the subway system, I think almost everything I've ever written, and in the ballpark, I think we had things like lack of charisma can be fatal, and raise boys and girls the same way. That was my admonition to the fans.
The whole idea of putting this kind of work, this quote-unquote art, in the midst of something or some place where one would not normally expect to find quote-unquote art, to be moved in such a way. Were people surprised by this?
I think so. For me, it's almost necessary that people don't even consider whether it's art or not, that they just judge it at face value. And this happens when they just come across it as an anonymous poster. Then they just think about what it says rather than what it is or who said it.
Now your things are being seen in museums. Mm-hmm. I actually saw your installation. It was part of your survival series, and I was at the Pompidou Museum in Paris, and I saw this electronic sign flashing at me. It couldn't have been. How big are they?
This is a relatively big one. I think it's about 10 feet long and 3 feet tall, something like that.
It was flashing on the wall, and it said, "Finding extreme pleasure will make you a better person if you're careful about what thrills you." I giggled. I was provoked. I took a picture of it. I have a picture of your installation in my photo album.
This is amazing.
Do you really think so? To be moved in that sort of way? I mean, I've sort of translated it into another art form, I guess.
No, I'm tickled. When you're doing public art, the number one thing is to have people notice. That's always the crux of it.
And that is your
I'm glad that you noticed that it was there.
And that is your number one thing, to have it noticed. Doesn't it get noticed differently in a museum? I was very comfortable in the museum. I felt, well, here I am, I can stand here, and I can appreciate it.
There's a major difference. The surprise, of course, is lost, but what's gained is that you are in a more comfortable setting, and it's more like going to the library when you're in a museum. You can have the leisure to contemplate it if you're at all interested. Mm-hmm. In the street, though, you do have the kind of shock and surprise value.
Do you censor yourself?
Yes.
You do?
It's necessary when you do public work to make sure that what I say is appropriate to the situation, isn't inflammatory just for the sake of being inflammatory. And then I also edit my things sometimes if they're just stupid. I have to make sure that those don't get out.
Some of them are very funny.
Yeah, that I think you have to leaven anything you do, and especially some of my things have to be leavened with some humor.
So getting people to laugh was part of your intent.
Sure, sure.
I found one. It's from your survival series. It says, spit all over someone with a mouthful of milk if you want to find out something about their personality fast.
Sure, it's the basic personality scan. You can find out a lot about somebody with that.
Seems a bit dangerous to me to try as an experiment, however.
Maybe so.
One as well, which is not quite as humorous, but one that gave a great pause for thought, for me anyway, it was, die fast and quiet when they interrogate you, or live so long that they're ashamed to hurt you anymore.
Mm-hmm. I guess maybe because I'm a member of Amnesty International, I keep reading torture cases, and so that was one written maybe in response to some of the things that I'd read.
Do you hope that you're going to change people's minds at all?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Try anyway.
Are you successful?
Occasionally.
How do you measure that?
Eavesdropping.
Do you?
That's my main source of feedback. I will go to wherever one of my things is playing, and I'll listen to see what kind of conversations it starts or what kind of debates or what kind of arguments in some cases.
What things have you learned from the people that are within the art world, and are they different than maybe what you had learned by just sort of eavesdropping?
The difference, I guess, within the art world would be that your work is discussed relative to other pieces of art, and that's always interesting. I want to succeed formally as well as with my content, I guess I'd say. So that's something that can be discussed by experts.
What kind of relationships are now being drawn between what you're doing and what's come in the been happening in the past?
People think about the conceptual people, and that it's maybe anti-commodity and uses language. I think there's somebody would trace a relationship with that. I think people relate it to political art that's been going on for quite some time. Those sort of parallels. And also sometimes when I will use something like an electronic sign, people talk about what that just means in formal terms.
And what does it mean in formal terms?
I guess it'd be a high-tech artist or a light artist.
What are you doing now?
Trying to write some things for television for 15-second spots that will be placed where normal commercials go.
Can you do that? Are you going to buy the time for this?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they'll let you do this?
I trust so. Mm. I'm working on a few ends. Hopefully I'll be able to execute it.
You're also working with granite benches?
Mm-hmm.
This seems like a total change of direction from something that twinkles by and is gone to something that is there.
I started, I think, one reason because I was tired of having electronic signs blow up. I wanted something eternal in Stone Age. Then the other reason was I also wanted a chance to start writing things longer than one-liners. I wanted to expand to at least paragraph length, and a bench is a more contemplative type object, so I can put something longer and more complex on it.
Thank you very much, Jenny Holzer, for being with us.
Thank you.
When I spoke to artist Jenny Holzer, she was in Philadelphia installing an electronic exhibit in the Bourse Building, an indoor shopping center, as part of the Constitution's bicentennial celebration. Since our conversation, the plug has been pulled on the exhibit until the organizers have a chance to install a large disclaimer saying the content does not reflect the opinions of the management. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who's co-hosting the program while Robert Siegel is on vacation, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Leanne. This is a substitute showcase here.
It sure is. What stories are you following today?
A lot of developments in the Persian Gulf will be on the program tonight, and the Environmental Protection Agency has decided to make some regulations, some preliminary regulations on chlordane, pesticide.
Are these new regulations?
As far as we know, it's the first attempt of the EPA to admit that there are actually some hazards associated with the use of chlordane as a pesticide around the homes to control cockroaches and other pests. The first that we know of.
Thanks, John. All Things Considered is coming up later on National Public Radio. The world as I found it, is a novel by Bruce Duffy, in which the main character is the 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein's real-life cronies and colleagues from the years he spent teaching at Cambridge are also characters in the novel. Our book critic John Leonard has a review.
Of Bruce Duffy, we're told only that he's 34 years old, married, and lives in Washington, D.C. He has chosen to write a very long first novel about the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. This is more than ambitious. It is almost presumptuous. When Wittgenstein bothered to talk at all, it was usually to other philosophers like Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore. Duffy presumes not only to read the minds of these three men, but to report on their dreams and their sex habits. The result is astonishing, sometimes wicked, sometimes sad, never reductive, a kind of opera in which each idea has its own aria. You don't have to know much about logical positivism to enjoy Duffy's music. You need only know that Wittgenstein's first theory of philosophy saw language as a great mirror. Language described life in word pictures, but couldn't describe itself because it was blinded by its own reflected radiance. Thus, certain subjects couldn't be talked about, among them such invisibilities as God, the mystical, and ethics. This left a lot unspeakable. Now imagine Wittgenstein, fresh from a Vienna that was the capital of alienation, arriving in Cambridge, England, that hothouse of the Enlightenment spirit, where men like Russell and Moore felt anything could be discussed and most of it settled through diligent effort. British parlor empiricism met, quote, a misery almost Miltonic. Wittgenstein, like a desert mystic, subsisted on bread, rainwater, and silence in the purity of his reproach. They knew he was brilliant, but lighten up, Ludwig. Eat something. Eating at Cambridge is one of Duffy's wonderful set pieces. In England, Duffy as novelist glitters, as light and antic clever as Aldous Huxley or Mary McCarthy in the groves of Academe. Abroad, the colors are darker. Wittgenstein, as a soldier, a teacher, an architect, and a hermit, obsessed by his secret sexuality and the suicides of three of his brothers, denying his Jewishness, this Wittgenstein is under heavy weather. It's amazing, in fact, how many of his metaphors are watery, bubbles and ripples, waves and drowning. But even death, he thinks, is just another metaphor for something else. He will become as much a poet as a philosopher, and he will change his philosophy. Language, he said late in his life, is the text, but pain, it seems, is the subtext. Duffy delivers as much as he presumes. He doesn't explain the philosophy by the philosopher's peculiarities. Rather, he permits us to imagine how original minds find in the metaphors they make of their lives those signs that cluster into clouds of ideas, and then lightning strikes. We see everything at once.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The World as I Found It by Bruce Duffy. Here's a look at the next edition of Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress and world champion baton twirler Sophie Hayden. She got to show off both her skills in Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the new album by the Kronos Quartet, the avant-garde chamber group that's achieving mainstream success. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will tell us how he learned to speak Italian. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.